Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Now, I did mention this on Twitter, but, you know, not everyone would have seen it. My little family and I, we've hit a few bumps, we're having a bit of turbulence, and we've had to take an unexpected trip away, and we're not quite exactly sure when we're going to be back. As far as Risky Business goes, I'll still be publishing, but I just don't have time at the moment to prepare feature segments and interviews. So for at least the next couple of weeks, the show will just consist of news and a sponsor interview. Now, I've received a million messages of support since I posted that little statement to Twitter. Big thanks to everyone who reached out to me, and sorry I haven't been able to reply. But look, there's no need to worry. Things are on the up. Everyone's going to be fine. We're just managing something that needs to be managed. That's the best way that I can think to put it. But anyway, shortly we'll be chatting with Adam Boileau about the week's news, and then we'll be hearing from Timothy Keeler from Remediant in this week's sponsor interview. Remediant is a small company that does privileged account management stuff, but don't worry, they're not a password vault play. Tim is joining us this week to walk through some of the challenges of managing privileged access in DevOps environments in particular, and also to talk a bit about some of the challenges around, a few things, single sign-on, privilege management, et cetera, et cetera. They also touch on a case study involving some work they did at Lockheed Martin. That's all good stuff, and it is coming up after the news. But yes, let's get into the news now, and I do apologise for any background noise you might hear this week. I'm not at home at the moment. I'm staying at a friend's apartment, and there is some rather vigorous home improvement happening next door. It's unavoidable. Sorry about that. But yes, Adam, a real mixed bag of news this week, and it looks like our Swift hackers are back. They had a pretty red-hot go at the Central Bank of Malaysia, prompting the Central Bank of the Philippines to put out an alert, which is how this news has actually got out there. I'm sort of surprised more outlets aren't covering this story, to be honest.
Yeah, it seems, according to the story, that Bank Negara Malaysia got hacked by somebody who got into their Swift system and tried to transfer some money out. It doesn't say how much or whether they succeeded, but yeah, clearly the bank security team caught it, you know, before or soon enough after the fact to make it go away. And then, yeah, the Philippine banks obviously are a little bit twitchy given their involvement in being the sort of vector through which the Bangladeshi Swift hacked money was vectored. So yeah, they're a little twitchy on the old announcement to warn people to be careful. But
you'd be twitchy too if you had to use Swift, right?
well, yes.
Yeah, and twitchy would be your permanent state.
I certainly have had my own personal experience with the some of the Swift plumbing, and yeah, I was twitchy. I can tell you that.
But you were twitching from excitement because you got to do horrible things to it. I know you too well, my friend. Now, look, turning our attention to CyberScoop, and they're carrying a story that says this company called Energy Services Group, which seems like kind of a big deal energy distribution company that processes, you know, energy market related transactions, have been having a bit of a hard time. But what is notable about this story is that it doesn't really contain much detail. But generally speaking, you know, when you see a story like this, you know, it can go two ways, right? It can be like, it turned out to be nothing, just some random DDoS, or it turned out to be a pretty frickin' big deal, and we just don't know yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of kind of winding up, you know, oh my God, hackers in the gas pipelines. I think as much detail as we have is that it was some billing system, like a third-party billing system for billing, you know, energy transactions was hacked. And then the upstream, one of the upstream users of that was involved in oil and gas pipelines and things. But yeah, the company's name, they're all like super, super generic. Energy Transfer Partners and Energy Services Group, neither of which appear to be the same company. One of them was hacked and something bad happened and no one really knows what. So yeah, super detailed reporting there. But either way, hackers in oil and gas pipelines is not a thing anyone wants, and probably is a thing that is happening lots and lots.
We've seen a fairly large breach impacting Under Armour, which is the sporty sports company. But yes, apparently something like 150 million accounts out there. They're kind of getting a lot of shit for some of those passwords being SHA-1. By the looks of things, most of them were bcrypt. My personal suspicion is that probably the reason some are SHA-1 and some are bcrypt is they began enrolling people into, you know, bcrypt storage and capturing and generating a bcrypt hash to replace the SHA-1 at time of login. And if someone hasn't logged in, then they wouldn't have got moved to bcrypt. That's the only scenario I can think of in my head for why we'd have a mixed database of hashes like this.
Yeah, I mean, assuming that the database is used by only one system, yeah, that's a pretty, you know, it seems to be the likely explanation. You know,
which kind of means I'm getting, you know, like I think it's kind of funny that people are like pointing at them and saying, boo, SHA-1, when it kind of looked like they were trying to do the right thing.
Well, yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously the, you know, the password hashing format is, you know, a thing that people worry about in terms of data breaches because it means you can recover the clear text passwords. But even bcrypt passwords, right? I mean, if they're dictionary words, you can still recover them. I mean, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, the real issue here is that the value of those passwords needs to be zero, i.e. that they're not useful for anything else, rather than particularly worrying about what particular hash format they are. But yeah, I think overall, most people, or at least some of the reporting we've seen so far, it's been pretty kind to them, I think. I mean, they seem to have identified the breach and reported it publicly like within a month, which, you know, from a world where Uber sits on stuff for years or whatever and only then tells you when their hand is forced, you know, doesn't seem like an unreasonable response. And yeah, the fact that they had any bcrypt at all, it's pretty good. So, yeah.
So, I think we're actually giving a biscuit to a company that got owned. That's a first.
maybe we're a bit Stockholm syndrome these days. I don't know.
I mean, could be it.
Doesn't
could
seem it's only 150 million users. I mean, big deal.
Now, I don't know if this one's technically a breach or a leak, but some company called Panera Bread, panerabread.com. Now, not being American, I have no idea what this is, but apparently it's some sort of, you know, sweet baked goods and coffee chain. They were leaking their customer data all over the internet in a pretty embarrassing way, which I've seen over my career quite a few times from quite a few companies that should have known better. What makes this one kind of funny is that the person who approached them and said, hey, you've got a problem here, was told to go away because you're a scammer. Which is, you know, also something I've seen through my career and been on the receiving end of a couple of times myself, actually.
Yeah, like this is so completely normal, especially, maybe it's just food service people, but this does seem to be a thing that happens, as you say, quite a lot.
So this was like their loyalty customer database and they just like left it in a web indexable directory or something? Is that what happened here?
I think it was incrementing numeric customer IDs or something, and you could just, you know, add one to the customer ID you got, and it would give you the next customer's details. So you could kind of increment through it all, direct object reference, pull down the data without auth. They fixed it by adding auth, but the auth was any customer. So like if you had an account, which I'm assuming you can sign up for on the site, then you could just go ahead and do it anyway. So yeah, it took them what, like 8 months to get around to actually fixing it properly, despite it being reported. And even then only after Krebs got involved and it got rather public. So yeah, no biscuits for the bread company.
No muffins for them. Now, of course, we spoke about the city of Atlanta having a pretty bad time. Apparently Baltimore's 911 emergency system also having a bad time.
Yeah, apparently ransomware got into the computerized dispatching system at the, you know, that handles figuring out where the emergency services vehicles are and where they're going, that the 911 call answering people use. So not the actual 911 calling system, but instead the dispatching system was shut down by ransomware, which obviously is not a desirable thing. Having, you know, emergency services run by pen and paper is pretty suboptimal, I imagine. But yeah, that's, you know, it's been a rough week for local governments in America.
Well, lucky there's no crime in Baltimore, right? Oh, dear. This just came across my desk this morning, actually. A blog post by Alex Stamos of Facebook. Apparently, they just canned a bunch of Internet Research Agency accounts. What's interesting about this, I guess, is that most of those accounts were actually Russian language pages with, you know, pretty substantial reach into Russian-speaking regions. So this isn't really related to, you know, US interference. This is more just like, we're kicking you off our platform as best we can.
Yeah, Stamos says that it's because they were misrepresenting their identity and they should just get thrown off the platform for that, not because necessarily the content of the pages in question. Facebook's blog post does have a couple of examples of some of the content. And as you say, like it looks fairly normal Facebook stuff rather than, you know, specifically evil scheming. But hey, who knows? They've been thrown off the platform and I guess Facebook's going to keep them, you know, stop them from coming back.
Friend of the show, Kelly Shortridge, actually kicked off this one. I think it was last week, actually. She noticed she had a honey file in some directory, and she noticed that like Chrome was accessing it, which sent her down a paranoid rabbit hole and wound
so
up.
Feeling.
Yeah, exactly. But it turns out that Chrome has integrated like very limited AV style scanning in order to determine if the browser's being hijacked. It's like an anti-hijacking feature but it got like InfoSec people's noses like really out of joint, which I got to say, like I get why you would worry about your browser touching your files in a way that you don't expect. I get how that would alarm you, but that doesn't mean I, you know, don't think that Google should be doing this. It actually seems like a pretty good idea.
Yeah, I mean, you can understand both sides of the, you know, of the debate. Well, it wasn't even a debate, really. Both sides of the story here. I mean, you know, obviously people don't want to be surprised by their computers, and there's rather a lot of that lately, you know,
yeah.
People just having their computers do things they didn't really expect. Whether or not their expectations matched, you know, were reasonable, I guess, is the other side of it, right? Where Google, you know, people were saying, oh my God, Google's scanning my stuff without consent. And to be fair, Google's, you know, details of the, you know, version changes and stuff in Chrome did say we've introduced limited antivirus based scanning.
Yeah, I think they'd actually blogged about it, right?
Yeah, right.
And some people are making hay of the fact that like various Google people have said, you know, AV sucks and whatever. But then Google's response to that is, hey, we actually sandboxed this and it wasn't that hard. Whereas there are antivirus makers out there, you know, earning ridiculous profits who can't throw a few people at sandboxing their products, and you know, we still think they suck.
Yeah, pretty much. And that seems entirely fair and reasonable to me. I mean, having the browser not get, you know, malicious plugins and other rubbish like that, and having some, you know, basic signature scanning of the place where Chrome's installed, or the documents, you know, the plugins, directory, settings, that kind of thing, doesn't seem unreasonable. And yeah, no. I mean, if anyone is going to do it right, I mean, can you imagine how stupid they would look if their AV was just as bad as every other one that Tavistock has wrecked.
Yeah.
Like, clearly they let Tavistock have a go at it, and it's probably not actually that awful. So, you know, I mean,
well, I mean, you know, I think, you know,
lose of writing a bad AV than anyone else.
Justin Xu jumped into the fray, you know, and sort of defended Google on this one, and he made some really good points. And one of them was people were saying, well, why can't you turn this off? And he's like, well, because if you could, it's an anti-hijacking measure. If you could turn it off, what's the first thing you're going to do? And it's like, huh, that's dude's making good points.
Yep. I mean, as the guy who was like literally last week turning off AV on a box that I just owned, yeah, like it's totally the thing that you do. You just first thing is turn off the protection mechanisms.
The Pentagon is launching a new bug bounty program, and you know, like, the only reason I'm specifically mentioning this one in the news is the target is its travel booking system, and you know that's going to be good hunting.
Yeah, like those sort of things are super complicated and filled with logic bugs. And yeah, I imagine some people are going to have some fun. The HackerOne program is running it again. I gather you have to be well regarded on the platform or win like a lottery place to get actually onto the program to do some bug hunting. So, you know, if you do get on that, good luck and Godspeed finding some travel bugs.
It's funny, you and I both know someone who's done pretty well out of the United frequent at the United Bounty Program, where they've wound up with like a ridiculous number of frequent flyer miles. And he was actually going to book me a flight. It didn't work out in the end, but it was funny just, you know, speaking to the call center and they're like, holy God, you got a lot of miles, right? And because we tried using the website prior to that, and just, oh my God, looking at that website, anything doing complicated bookings, you know, they're held together with string. And I'm like, I think you're going to still be able to earn some more miles. I don't think you're going to run out of things to find on this one.
Yeah. Yes, they are very much built out of old spackled together bits.
They are. Now, the state of Georgia in the United States has passed this law. Now, over the last few months, I've heard people sort of, you know, getting in a bit of a twist about this one, because it basically takes away the intent component of the computer offense of, like, you know, gaining unauthorized access to a computer. So, you know, like, people doing uninvited bug bounties are definitely on the wrong side of the law there now. People do seem to be freaking out about this, but I don't see how it's actually out of step with a lot of laws in a lot of other places. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that people were more relaxed about that. You know, maybe other laws were more relaxed. Whereas, yeah, in other parts of the world, you know, you'd already get in trouble for doing that kind of thing. I mean, unsolicited bug bounties are not a thing. Like, that's just computer hacking. So, I mean, I guess the things that people are worried about, I suppose, are, you know, when you are using a service and you kind of stumble across something, or you accidentally, you know, spot a thing that turns out to actually be bad, and then you go and try and report it.
Yeah,
maybe it's another avenue for it to go wrong for you.
Yeah, that's a really reasonable thing. Like, you know, incrementing a number in a URL to see if a customer record pops up, because you just have that feeling, right? And that's something a lot of people do. I guess this bill would criminalize that, and that is a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly is. And there's plenty of other, you know, sort of edge cases where, you know, sort of, I mean, the example, one of the examples used was like Shodan, where it's not really, it's just kind of collecting and indexing information, but that kind of facilitates it, and that kind of stuff can get pulled in a way that, you know, isn't really what it intended. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah, we'll have to see what, yeah, if any prosecution comes out of it.
Well, you'd expect a bit of judicial discretion on that, wouldn't you? But I guess this makes that more difficult, and you know, all it takes is for one overly zealous prosecutor, and you know, next thing you know, you got someone who doesn't deserve it up on charges, serious charges too. So there you go. Oh, now this is interesting. Reality Winner, who is the NSA contractor, who is of course accused of leaking information relating to, you know, Russian election hacks or whatever, she's just dropped a bunch of subpoenas, apparently targeting all sorts of InfoSec companies like Trend Micro, FireEye, ESET, CrowdStrike, Velexity, F-Secure, ThreatConnect, SecureWorks, Fidelis. Other reporting is saying that they've also dropped a subpoena on Vice Motherboard, which seems a bit strange. And we don't actually know why this is and what the reasoning behind it is yet. And I did the rounds this morning, like asking multiple contacts at, you know, a few of these organizations what they know. And no one really seems to know anything yet. And at least one of them said that they hadn't even received the papers. So this is all a bit confusing at this stage, but it could get real interesting.
Yeah, well, I guess the question is exactly what she's asking for. I mean, presumably this is part of the defense of her charges for, you know, of espionage for leaking documents to The Intercept, allegedly leaking documents to The Intercept. But yeah, it's really hard to know what's going on. But yeah, it seems like a rather, you know, scattergun selection of organizations, and I'm not quite sure where it's heading.
Well, I guess if you could prove that, like, the entire private sector, InfoSec, you know, community knew exactly what was contained in that report, that it being so highly classified might not make sense, right? I mean, that could be one angle.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable angle, but yeah, we just don't know yet, eh?
No, we don't. Look, a great story here from Politico about John Bolton, who has just been appointed or will be appointed National Security Advisor to US President Donald Trump.
Sorry.
It's interesting.
The concept's look, ridiculous, but anyway, yes, carry on.
I just can't believe this guy's back, you know what I mean? Like after all last time. I mean, the guy strikes me as a bit of a f***ing psycho, actually. He's very much of the opinion that America should flex its muscles and invade countries and just basically be as aggressive as possible all the time, which isn't really the sort of person I feel super comfortable having Trump's ear. But he's been speaking a bit about cyber stuff. And his opinion seems to be that the US should just go buck wild owning everyone who's ever even thrown a malicious packet at them. And Politico has a good write-up.
Yeah, apparently he's on record as saying that the US cyber, you know, cyber troops should use WikiLeaks as target practice, which, you know, I don't know quite what form that takes. But yeah, the idea that, you know, a good cyber offense is somehow a good defense is, you know, I think patently ridiculous. But I don't know, I guess he's expecting that there's some kind of relationship between, you know, mutual assured destruction and sort of deterrence thinking and cyber, which I don't really know that there is, and hopefully someone will explain to him how the cybers actually work and, you know, the fact that America probably has more to lose than most people on the other end of their cyber rings.
That's the thing, right? And I think the piece points out that others who worked under the Obama administration did look at some scenarios and just thought, no, this will actually make it worse, right? But it seems like we're dealing increasingly with a government in the United States that doesn't really accept conventional wisdom, shall we say. So, yeah, I mean, we might see various agencies in the United States taking on, we might see their missions changing, right? And that could get pretty ugly pretty quick if this guy gets his way, which is the only reason I put the story in this week's news.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the natural consequences if America did go on the offensive using its, you know, military and intelligence cyber capabilities, that, you know, non-government targets, U.S. corporations, U.S. citizens, you know, are going to be the ones that take the brunt of a response from other countries, not necessarily government organizations. Like, it's not a, you know, this kind of thing has real impact for all of our listeners that are, you know, working in the commercial space entirely unrelated to international relations, because they become targets. You know, and we look at how well NotPetya took out, you know, big multinational corporations' businesses rather than its actual intended targets in the Ukraine. Like, I mean, there is real collateral damage options
I mean, I just sort of feel like it would be a Pandora's box scenario, and you're sort of unleashing the horsemen of the cyberpocalypse. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not. it just doesn't seem. It seems like something you'd want to think through. I mean, that's not to say that the United States wouldn't do well by being perhaps a little more aggressive in some circumstances, right? That there might be a case to be made for that, but just saying we're going to go buck wild and just smash everyone, like, that's not going to end well.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, on the other hand, I guess we just don't know where this path leads. I mean, we haven't really seen what open, you know, like open cyber season would look like.
Well, it'd be good for us.
Well, we'd certainly have a busy news week, that's for sure.
That's
assuming
right.
that we could even do, you know, that we could even do this.
Assuming that we could communicate over the internet,
over the IP
yes.
network. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, well, anyway, that's just something interesting worth keeping an eye on. Ars Technica reports that two more ICO founders have been arrested and charged with fraud by the SEC. So it looks like their little cyber unit is kicking some ass, as they say in America.
Yeah, indeed. These are the two founders from Centratech, who made some, you know, like Ethereum-based ICO that, you know, just was complete scam. And they made tens of millions of dollars. And yes, now they're going to go down for it, which seems pretty reasonable to me.
Yeah. Oh, there's been an announcement from MITRE, which I think is interesting. It's time, right? Like, because we have seen various pay-to-play, like, endpoint security and AV testing companies here and there. And, you know, some of them do really good work, but it's not really standardized and they'll only work with some vendors and then their competition won't want to work with them or vice versa, right? So MITRE Corporation is now offering evaluations basically of EDR products and they want to make all of the findings public. I'm really cautiously optimistic that this might actually go somewhere good. What do you think?
I think I agree with you, actually. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the individual endpoint and detective controls do and how attackers move around, you know, how they escalate their access, how they move laterally around the environment, all the things that are well captured in the MITRE attack framework. So this marries MITRE's attack taxonomy with testing of specific products, and then we'll produce some output that says this product is capable of detecting and potentially stopping this, you know, particular scenario from the attack taxonomy. And for people who are buying these products based on what salespeople say, and the salespeople are just telling you complete bollocks about what the capabilities of the products are, then they'll have some actual data to draw on because, yeah, people are surprised when, you know, their, you know, FireEye agent that's designed specifically for use and response doesn't, you know, detect something that's not, you know, an incident that's in progress that's unrelated to what it's for. So people seem to be very confused about what post-AV products are for. And I think this is a really good way to tie, you know, the sort of taxonomic work, taxi work.
Yes.
To tie the work that MITRE has done in, you know, building good taxonomies into something that actually relates to people's products. Because most people look at the MITRE and go, oh, look, there's too many words. I can't be bothered reading all this. I don't understand how it relates to my thing anyway and move on. Whereas making it real about the individual products, I think it's really useful. So, yeah, good idea.
I had a good chat with someone who does work in evaluating these types of products. And what was really interesting is, you know, they do a lot. The problem is a lot of this work is private, right? Like you never get to see the results because it's for, mega corporation X. But some of the stuff they told me, I won't repeat it here. This is a topic for another day. But I will just say that some of the good performers are the ones you wouldn't actually expect for certain things. Do you know what I mean? So like stopping lateral movement, it might be vendor X, but they're rubbish at detecting like frontline malware. Whereas some other one that you just wouldn't expect to just absolutely kicks ass in terms of preventing exploitation and malware. So yeah, I suspect that when we start seeing results trickle out of this, there's going to be some surprises. And I would imagine that the results of this, if they can get a comprehensive set of vendors to participate, it might actually be a little bit useful, more useful than the research output from a company like, say, Gartner.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And certainly as an attacker, it would be really helpful to go look at a table and go, okay, I'm on a box with this, this, and this.
What does it suck at?
Snap me doing? Like, what does it suck at? What's it going to snap me at? Like, that would be really helpful because I don't know either, right? We get in the box, we see a security product. It's like, but what is it? What does it do? Right? You go and read the marketing. It does everything. Oh my God, look at the padlocks. But what does it actually do? We don't know. So yeah, I would love to read this output. So please,
great. So you want MITRE Corporation to do evaluations of EDR products so you know how to attack the users better. That's not quite what this is about, Adam. But good to know. Some poor Russian bloke has been extradited to the United States for owning LinkedIn, Dropbox and Formspring, pleading not guilty in a federal court in San Francisco, which, generally doesn't work out so well, Guy.
Yeah, he was picked up in the Czech Republic. And the funny thing about that was he was also slated to be extradited to Russia. And the Russians had him for like $3,000 worth of web money theft, which did rather seem like, we better help our buddy out and see if we can get him back to Russia quick. Someone find something wrong that he did. But yes, the Czechs, after some internal political wrangling, because apparently some political factions wanted him to send him to Russia and some wanted to send him to the US, he has now arrived in the US and the Czechs are sorting out their domestic issues as a result of the mess.
Yes, but I can't expect he's going to have too much luck pleading not guilty in a US federal case because their conviction rate in federal is just, insane. Like, why even bother with the courts, right? and this is a good one, man. And I'm not saying that seriously please, digital rights listeners. I'm not actually suggesting we get rid of the judiciary, just so you know, just so I can explicitly state it. That's not what I'm saying. Lizard Squad, man. One of the Lizard Squad guys whose Twitter handle was FBI are losers. Yeah, he's been done with the FBI, but great news for him is he's only going to do 3 months in prison because he snitched, man. He sang like a canary.
Yeah, he was really facing 10 years and then he was such a good snitch that they the prosecution dropped it down to 2.5 years and then the judge gave him 3 months. Apparently he still broke down in tears in court. I'm not sure whether that's for joy or for snitching or for out of fear of going to jail for 3 months, the remaining bit of his sentence that he has left. But yes, I guess just, tweaking the FBI's nose on Twitter and expecting it not to end badly for you. What were you thinking?
Come at me, bro. Okay. That's the thing. Now, I just wanted to mention that we said, I introduced the story last week by saying, Boeing got WannaCry'd. You pointed out that it wasn't actually WannaCry. It was like, I think you described it as a variant, which is still kind of a fair description because really it was just other rubbish ransomware written with the Eternal Blue exploit. But a couple of people wrote to us going, you need to correct that. But Boeing didn't actually get WannaCry, they got Eternal Blued with WannaCry-like malware. I guess the interesting thing here is they've actually now pushed back on the initial reporting and saying that it was pretty overblown and that the rubbish ransomwareing was actually pretty limited internally.
Well, that's very good for them because I imagine having your entire organization owned by WannaCry would have gone very badly for Boeing. So yes, good on them for not getting wrecked by WannaCry or similar.
Tor has discontinued Tor Messenger after 2.5 years. And this is a project, it kicked off just before I got involved with Ricochet. I never really understood it because all it does is plumb you through like a Tor client to an XMPP server. So you're dodging one type of metadata, but you're still leaving a whole bunch of other metadata on the XMPP servers. I think, the thing that really killed it was they tied the project to Mozilla's Instant Bird, which is no longer under development. And, after a bunch of money spent and a bunch of time thrown at it, it is now dead. So long live Ricochet is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't think this is a surprise. Like building new software, even 2 years ago, on anything Bird, like anything based on Mozilla's, 25-year-old code base, was a terrible idea. Quite apart from the architectural concerns that, that you outlined in terms of metadata and stuff. Like, it's just a bad idea to use that code base. I don't think I'm surprised that this has died.
Here we go. Another Hilarabad Mac OS X High Sierra bug in, file system bug, man. This one's a shocker as well.
Yeah, apparently if you are using external encrypted drives with APFS through file system, it's logging the passwords in clear text to logs on the disk. So anyone who gets access to your machine can then decrypt your external storage. So that's a bit of a boneheaded one, especially given that Apple's own guidelines say that that's probably not a thing you should be doing. I think they have fixed it in the most recent High Sierra patch. But silly Apple. That was a terrible idea.
Now here's a fun one, man. Someone just started, I'm guessing burp sweeting or whatever, these live chat support agents, a very commonly used one. And when they looked at the info coming back, they saw that it was like basically telling the client, on the receiving end of support, everything about the employee on the other end. And that's not good.
No, it does seem rather surprising. I mean, not the least because I never realize those life support things actually had real people. Like, I thought they were just chatbots. Like, I didn't know they were actual people. I feel bad now. But yes, some of these products do give out a whole bunch of information about the person on the other end. In some cases, the email address that they are using to sign in. In other cases, you know, like all sorts of organizational details about their name and where they are and who their boss is and all that kind of organizational structure stuff, which perhaps you could then use to, you know, carry out pretexting attacks or something else.
Well, it's just, I mean, they just shouldn't be leaking that information. I think, and I made a mistake, it's actually two different packages that are affected. There's Touch Commerce and Live Chat. And, you know, Touch Commerce users include Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, Bell, Cox Communications, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Citizens Bank. And the Live Chat users include Google Fiber, Kaspersky Labs, Bitdefender, TorGuard VPN. You know, I mean, so these are big deal enterprises that are using, you know, chat support software that's spraying their employees' details all over the internet. So that's not good.
Yeah, it seems pretty poorly thought through.
Yeah. Adam, I just want to finish up with a reading recommendation for the handful of people who are really going to want to dive into this one. It is a US government document titled Findings of the Investigation into China's Acts, Policies and Practices Related to Technology Transfer, Intellectual Property and Innovation under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. In other words, it's a really catchy title.
Yes, happy,
it is a hundreds of pages long report into China stealing stuff, basically, and it is very comprehensive.
Yeah, that sounds like it might be a very relevant read for anyone who's had their intellectual property thieved by the Chinese or others over the years. Having a bit of a context when you're talking to your board about how bad it is. So, yes, probably worth a squiz.
Worth a squiz. All right, Adam, that is actually it for this week's news. We're not going to speak to you next week because you're going to be down in Canberra for B-Sides. And I think the week after that, it's a maybe at this point. But, look, we'll chat to you when we chat to you.
Yep, now I've got a few things to do. So, yes, I will catch up with you and the rest of the news and all of the terrible things that happened next time I can.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Timothy Keeler of Remediant. Remediant are a small but growing company that makes some pretty specific tech around privileged access and account management. They just published a case study recently about work they did with Lockheed Martin in this area, but basically Lockheed's compliance burden got kicked up a notch because they deal in defense-related information, and they needed to do more about their privileged access management. They looked at password vaults, decided they didn't like them, and wound up doing work with Remediant to lock things down, you know, quickly, because that's one of the advantages of their tech. A handful of you out there know I will sometimes connect CISOs with sponsors of this program. They might ask me to send them a summary of, you know, 10 vendors and then ask to be connected with one or two of them. It's not something I do often, but I did connect Remediant with one of my CISO pals, and the feedback was actually very positive. And they say for the time invested with their products, you can actually get a lot done. Anyway, Remediant became a sponsor because they listen to the show and they like it. And Remediant founder and CEO, Tim Keeler, heard the interview I did with Signal Sciences co-founder Zane Lackey a few weeks ago, where we talked about the complexity of multi-cloud and DevOps environments. And yeah, he wanted to add his two cents and contribute to that conversation, but more speaking about it from an access perspective. Timothy Keeler joins me now. And mate, I definitely get the sense that when it comes to ridiculously complicated multi-cloud DevOps setups, you know, do you also get the impression that when it comes to people running those environments, they may have bitten off a little bit more than they realized they'd be chewing? Like, is that a fair characterization?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with Zane's comments anymore. And I think that's really the biggest challenge in information technology today is DevOps has created this process that just has enabled IT to move insanely fast. And security is having such a hard time keeping up with that. When DevOps releases their new version, security comes in after the fact and says, all right, it's going to take us some time to do the analysis and figure out any potential security holes.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Tim, that's not actually how DevOps is supposed to work. I mean, I hear you. This is what happens, but that's not how it's supposed to work.
Well, I mean, DevOps is, they're deploying and security is just falling behind. It's not like they go through a new version and then they wait on security. You know, what they've realized is, all right, you know, we just need to continuously integrate, continuously deploy. everything in the in their product, and then security is stuck behind saying, all right, how do we actually get visibility into this, right? And so when we take a look at the cloud-centric models where you have instances in AWS or Azure, whatever your cloud platform is, literally coming up for minutes and then coming down, security doesn't have any visibility into that, right? And DevOps has just had this, they've created this process that lets them to be completely fluid and completely dynamic. And that's where we really believe, dynamic authorization plays an important role in that aspect.
Well, I'd imagine it would too, because, really on the operations side, because it's everything just gets so much more complicated when you're talking about spinning up point in time Docker images to do this, and you've got this account over here and that account over here, and it's this all singing, all dancing thing. But it is very complicated, and managing that auth and access in a dynamic way is pretty difficult.
Yeah, let's take a look at the Linux world for an example. Right now, all of these instances that come up really run in their own isolated state. And now where security has traditionally played a role is, okay, we have this existing infrastructure with Active Directory. So, they try to bring Linux into this directory-based world for centralized authentication. But going through that process means you have to either uproot the PAM authentication on that box, or you have to, install some sort of agent that bridges that into Active Directory and let that become your centralized solution. But DevOps just doesn't operate in that world. So, they don't want to connect all these systems, right? Because that's a heavy load, that's a heavy lift that changes their entire process. And that's really where we were trying to take our new approach with Linux of, hey, no agents, no touch on that system, but just create a really elegant way that brokers the authentication into the Linux world that you already have with your existing AD investment.
Now, look, I'm sure the listeners heard from that this is an area where you're playing and you think you've got a good solution. But what are some of the other approaches to this that you've seen that might have been successful? Are there other tool makers out there doing this well, or that you can think of? I mean, different approaches to you. I'm not asking you to plug your competitors. I'm just,
Oh, yeah. essentially the way that the process happens is you change the PAM authentication module in your Linux environment, and that connects it to Active Directory, so you have your authentication. But the real challenge for those approaches is, all right, you don't use sudo anymore, you use another process, and then you have to, you have to retrain all of your admins, you have to plan in downtime for your Linux environment just to convert over to this process. And then if you have any existing tool sets that use things like sudo, you have to engage this whole other process. And I think a lot of organizations find that too heavy of a lift. So they've just been trying to kind of manage along, with general sudo implementation. But now they're really...
So you're saying they're just like scripting all of this stuff?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And and really what
that's,
they
that's,
want
that's
is
that's great until your Linux guru gets hit by a bus or a better offer, right?
that's exactly right.
Do you think one of the reasons there's a bit of a gap in the market around privileged access management is because the security industry, to a degree, has been just so effective in pushing this idea that 2FA is the solution to everything?
I certainly think there's an element of that. I think the biggest struggle with is, everyone knows 2FA is a good thing. And as we look forward, across all these new authentication models, we're going to see, passwords start going away. But the reality is you can't apply two-factor to everything. You really want to apply it to the things that are going to be, important to protect. And, when we take a look at single sign-on, it provides a really great advantage, but you don't want to be re-authenticating every time you want to try to perform some sort of action. What you really need to do is just focus on the things that are important, that usually those are ones with administrative level control.
Now, obviously, DevOps isn't necessarily your core business. It's an area where you play it. It's an area where you feel you can help. You just published an interesting case study, though, about some more bread and butter privileged access management, that work that you did with Lockheed Martin. That was interesting because, the thing that I found interesting about that was very much driven by regulatory changes that defense contractors faced that required them to lift their their access management game. And they went out and looked at things like password vaults and just went, nope. But can you tell us a little bit about those regulatory changes?
Yeah, so the DoD introduced it as the new mandates under the DFARS. That's the Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement Rules, where it required all the government contractors in the defense space to essentially adopt the NIST 800-171 standards. And really what that means is there were some particular clauses where there was about 110 security controls defined in NIST that needed to be implemented. Now, the one that was actually affected Lockheed the most is they really needed a quick, easy way to implement two-factor authentication across all their privileged access systems.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, people who are familiar with your company know that that's, you know, that's very much the where your solution plays is about, you know, sort of centralizing management of privileged accounts and, you know, applying the multi-factor authentication to your stuff as a sort of choke point. What I found interesting about the case study, though, was that a company like Lockheed went out there and looked at, because, you know, auditability and all of that stuff was a big deal as well. They went out and they looked at password vaults, and that's a pretty established market segment. They just looked at them and they went, nope. I was kind of surprised that there was a gap in the market for you guys to fill, to be honest.
Yeah, what they realized is that the legacy password vault solutions, they just simply don't meet the requirements for dynamic privilege access. And when we take a look at, you know, administrative credentials and how they get compromised, two-factor authentication becomes increasingly important. And I think we can all safely say in the industry right now that it's a matter of when admin credentials get compromised, not a matter of if anymore. So that was really kind of the focus of realizing those things, figuring out a way to implement two-factor authentication where there doesn't disrupt a lot of the business and really only apply that to the privileged access accounts.
Yeah. Now, I mean, forgive me for saying this, but your product isn't rocket science, right? Like it's not that hard to fix this problem. Why is it, do you think, that there's not too many people taking your approach? Because I'm surprised.
Yeah. So I think everyone has been looking at this problem from the wrong direction, where we typically focus on the authentication aspect. Now, while the authentication components are extremely important, and this is where two-factor comes into play, it doesn't make it realistically applicable to every application, every operating system, everything that you try to do with two-factor authentication. Now, the way we actually look at this is rather than focusing on the authentication bit, let's really take a look at the authorization components. Where does that identity have access to? And as we move closer to an identity-centric world in IT, that becomes increasingly important.
Now, look, I mean, I'm sure most people would think that the gold standard is for everyone to be running around with YubiKeys or, you know, sort of duo push-based solutions. But this is about having something that you can deploy pretty quickly that just gets you a long way. I mean, I guess that's why I'm surprised that there's not much competition for you in this area.
Yeah, I mean, you made a great point about YubiKey. And, you know, the reality of it is while you go through the first bit of authentication through a YubiKey in the Windows platform, where that gets converted into a single sign-on token and gets stored in memory, there's just a tons of different attacks where an attacker can get a hold of that token and now use that to move around the network. So that's really where our concept of just-in-time administration fits in. So what we think about access is that it should be dynamic. Is when you take a look at all of your administrators, they shouldn't have 24/7 access to all the systems in the network when really what they're doing on their day-to-day basis is just logging into a small handful of servers. So that was really our philosophy and our approach is, well, let's just create an easy-to-use interface that has two-factor authentication through our web interface. But rather than all these accounts just having that level of privilege, let's just add it to the system for however long they need to do their job. And then when they're done, we simply take that away. And this way, you actually stop the ability for an attacker to use those credentials to laterally move around the network, because you're essentially taking all of your infrastructure and moving it down to, you know, a zero trust, a least privileged model across everything on the enterprise.
Timothy Keeler, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about, privileged account management.
Patrick, it's been a pleasure.
That was Timothy Keeler of Remediant there. Big thanks to him for that. They'll be at RSA. They're having a party there too, and I'll give you all some details on that next week. But that is it for this week's show. Big thanks to everyone who's helped us out this week. You're all legends. I'll be back next week. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.